Let me give you a very quick review on these things, because I don't think that these things are very easy for you to understand, particularly since you people are not philosophers and you're not used to this. What I've been doing, again, just a very quick review, I've been distinguishing two very broad movements in ethics. God, some amateurs been using this, haven't they? There we go. I've been distinguishing two very broad movements in ethics called consequentialism and non-consequentialism. We can distinguish particular theories of ethics into one of these two classes. And I was talking last time about consequentialism. And the point about the consequentialist position is that moral behavior attaches only to consequences, not actions themselves. Actions themselves are subordinate to consequences, in that actions are defined as being right or wrong in terms of whether they produce good consequences or bad consequences. And therefore, the rightest action is the one that produces the best set of consequences. So what a consequentialist is trying to do is to maximize something. And particular theories which fall under the consequentialist rubric are particular theories which tell us what the something that people are trying to maximize is, and exactly how that maximization process should be carried on. There is a little bit of discussion on the second point. I was talking last time about average utility versus total utility. So it's not so the statement imperative, maximize these good consequences, is a little bit ambiguous. It might mean, in the case of utilitarianism, maximize total utility, or it might mean maximize average utility. Is there a poltergeist in here, is there? Gets turned on by squeaky doors, just like I do. I distinguished four different varieties of consequentialism last time. The hedonism of Bentham, which was criticized by Mill, who was talking about it being perhaps only fit for swine if we're trying to maximize merely pleasure and pain. Maybe there are higher pleasures, and Mill defined his concept of happiness in terms of maximizing these higher pleasures, reading Greek, listening to philosophy lectures and so on, going to plays, doing all those sorts of things, rather than sitting around boozing and stuff like that. Then we had a third variety of consequentialism, which I also classified as a kind of utilitarianism, which is called preference satisfaction, and that's even more kind of bloodless. It suggests that people have certain preferences, we find out what those are, and then act in such a way as to try to maximize those preferences. And then finally there was a Singerian view, which was the interest theory view, and for those of you that might have got a copy of Singer's book, you can read a bit about that. I didn't classify that as a kind of utilitarianism. I think that I'm not sure about whether we should or not. Singer doesn't. And I think perhaps we shouldn't, because in a way, people have interests, and they might not be the kind of things that they personally want to maximize. If my health is in my interest, which it seems to be, and I'm also an alcoholic, then I might desperately want to go and drink, but that perhaps wouldn't be in my interest. Perhaps it would be in my interest not to drink. And so a good consequentialist who held Singer's view about interests would say, well, let's refrain from letting Forge loose in Le Cork. Let's hold him back and direct him to a cafe up the street, even though that's what he really wants to do. So the interest theory seems to me not quite the same thing as utilitarianism. For me, my utility might be to go and booze if I'm an alcoholic, or go and get drugs if I'm a drug addict, or whatever, or smoke if I'm a smoker. But it might not really be in my interest to do that. So maybe we'll classify Singer's interest theory as not a version of utilitarianism. Maybe you people are not too excited by that distinction, but still, we'll mention it. What I'm going to get round to talking about at some stage today is the second broad sweep of ethics, the non-consequentialist theory, and that takes a quite different view. Again, I've suggested to you that a little theory of ethics should have two things. It should have a value specification and an action condition. For the case of the consequentialist, it's the value specification which, as Professor J.L. Austin at London at Oxford used to say, wears the trousers. Whereas in the non-consequentialist, it's the action condition which is important. It's the actions that you do which morality attaches to. and then the value, so to speak, is derivative or supervened upon, or some such word, upon the particular kind of action that you take. So it's a different sort of kind of ethics from the consequentialist ethics. I said one of the differences between ethics and morality was that ethics, we try to offer some kind of justification, some reasons. You can be a moral person and not know it. Sorry, that's not right. You can be a moral person and not know why it is that you're being moral. You can simply live a good moral life without being able to justify what you're doing. You might be a very moral person, but you can't, so to speak, justify it. I hope last time that you began to see how theories of ethics offer justifications. One of the things, for instance, Mill said was that the ends, that the nature of all human action is to act towards some end. And that might remind you, perhaps, of what I said before about rationality. What I said about rationality a couple of lectures ago was that rationality is about selecting means for ends. And what Mill said, you might recall, I read you a little bit of John Stuart Mill at the beginning there, and he said, the nature of human action is such that it is always directed toward an end. That's the purpose of human action, to be directed towards some kind of end. We are purposive creatures. We don't go about acting arbitrarily, just experiencing things. Rather, we have ends in view. We might have general sorts of plans, and these plans are involved with means for ends and so on. And from that, one might think, oh, well, there's no other choice but consequentialism, because it seems that these ends are the consequences of our actions, and these means are the actions themselves. So it may look as if we've got actions to consequences, and it may look as if what John Stuart Mill is saying is that we're the kind of creatures that, in fact, have the consequences of our actions in view when we do things. And if that's true, is there any alternative but consequentialism? Now again, he's offering us a general argument there for this whole kind of ethics. And then he gives another argument where he says, well, the consequences that we want are consequences that maximize happiness. And he then refers back to Bentham, and he refers to other stuff on happiness. And he gives reasons why it's consequences of this nature which we ought to be trying to maximize. So what John Stuart Mill, in the book I read from you, to you from, called On Utilitarianism, is doing, is trying to give reasons. He's doing ethics. He's not simply writing down a moral code. He's offering some justification for that moral code. I myself, me, personally, don't think this has to follow. If I did, if I thought that rationality somehow implies consequentialism, if that's all there is to it, then I would be committed to being a consequentialist, because what I said before about moral responsibility, I had that condition about rationality in it. A morally responsible person is a rational person who is acting in certain ways voluntarily, causing things to happen. If I thought that rationality implied consequentialism, well, we could forget about the non-consequentialist, forget about that completely, and we could go on and just give some other consequentialist theories of ethics and forget about this other movement of ethics, if that were true. I don't think it's true, because I think that, in a way, these things can be, so to speak, coterminous. The means and the ends can be the same thing. And the example that Schneider and I agree on is weightlifting. Here, we go to the gym. Since this time, I've spoken to many of you in the gym. I've spoken to others of you running. I've spoken to others of you on the tennis court. And all of these people that I've spoken to about this agree that we're lifting weights just because we like doing it. The action is an end in itself. We like picking up weights. We like putting them down. We're not trying to get big. We're not trying to sculpt the quads. We're not doing any of that stuff. When we go running, we just like the experience of running. Okay, our knees are bad. We've got bad ankles. The right tendon's a problem. But we're just running because we enjoy the experience of running. We're playing tennis because we like to hit the ball across the net. We don't care about winning. Don't care about improving. Don't care about getting in the next round of the tournament. We just like doing the action. The action itself is an end in itself. I believe that. I think, as I said to you this on Monday, I think that makes perfectly good sense. If it's always the case that everything we do is to some end, this seems to me to be a very frustrating kind of thing. I mean, what is this end that we're always doing things toward? Do we ever get there? I mean, is everything I do a means to an end, which is a means to an end, and so on and so on and so on? If that's all it is to rationality in action, I think that life will be very frustrating, because you're never actually involved in what you want. It's always an end in the future. It's always a consequence of your action that's in view. So I don't believe this is true. In other words, I don't believe that to be a rational person implies you have to be a consequentialist. I also think that there's something a bit more one can say about the distinction between actions and consequences. And I gave a talk at a little ethics conference at Queensland University last September. And I thought it was quite good. I mean, I was the only one that knew how to work the overhead projector, for instance. As you can see, I know how to work an overhead projector. And I'll tell you about this conference. This was on professional ethics, right? It was from professionals talking about professional ethics. And we had this conference and people would come and talk. And I sat there in bewilderment, because we had about, I think, total of, it was oversubscribed. I think we had 20 minutes total, I think. And the idea was to have sort of a 10 to 12 to 15 minute presentation and some discussion. And just about everybody said, oh, I'm running out of time. I'll have to skip this bit. And they were skipping bits and, you know, sort of going to here and overhead, and they had little overheads that you couldn't read, and they had this and that. I thought, well, are these supposed to be professionals, you know, teachers and people like that? And almost all of the talks I went to, you could either not read the overhead, or people were skipping, or people were confused, or people were incoherent. And then came my talk, you know, clear as you could. Hello, everybody. So this was about discussing some of these points. How exactly do we distinguish actions from consequences? And it was a question that I'd had in the back of my mind from giving this course. So I might tell you about that next week sometime, because I discovered I don't actually have a lecture on the moral code. I thought I did. So if I don't, shouldn't tell you that. I'm thinking of using these tapes, by the way, to apply for promotion. Do you think that would be a good idea? You see, I mean, I'm only doing it for my mother. I'm not like that, really. So I thought, well, you know, that you're supposed to give a teaching something. What's it called? Portfolio, that's right. And I thought, what better than to give them so many tapes? And all these happy questions and interjections and laughter and, you know, students smiling away and having a good time. I thought, well, what more could they want than that? Right? Testimony from Nixon here, how he'd like to have a beer with me downtown. And, you know, Schneider in the gym, I would think he'd have a wonderful time. Then they would say, well, teaching isn't relevant anymore, Ford. Sorry, it's not something that we're concerned with. Anyway. I'm completely lost now. Yes, so that's what I'll do. Consequentialism. Now, I didn't tell you some of the possible problems with consequentialism. I was going to read you some stuff from my friend Charles's handbook here. So, let me offer you some possible difficulties with consequentialism. What's very interesting about professional ethicists, and I'm not really, I mean, this is, I'm a philosopher, but philosophy of physics, I suppose, is my main interest in philosophy. I'm not seeped in ethics from mother's knee. But those that are seem to have some very sort of strong views about their position. For instance, Charles, who's wrote these notes, just hates consequentialism. He just hates it. And you know, he can't see why anybody would be a consequentialist. Singer, on the other hand, can't see the other side of it. He can't see why anybody would not be a consequentialist. Singer thinks it's obviously right. So there's a sort of interesting kind of gestalt here with people that ethicists seem to divide one way or the other. Let me offer you some, give you some counterexamples. These are stories, make-up stories, but not totally unbelievable, where it seems that if we take the consequentialist line, we get the wrong answer. Charles is talking about utilitarianism here, so I'll read it as he wrote it, but we don't have to worry about utility. I could call it consequentialism. Okay, here's the first one. So-and-so tells the story of a southern sheriff who must frame an innocent black man, this is an obvious example, in order to head off a riot led by the Ku Klux Klan, in which many lives will be lost. According to consequentialism, the frame-up must be done because it would have the best consequences. But, says Charles, the frame-up would be unjust and therefore morally wrong. So the idea is this, that there's some kind of difficult situation down in the boondocks in Texas near the jail at Huntsville, where a white man's just been executed for murdering a black man, say, which is highly unlikely in Huntsville, Texas, but let's suppose it happened. And there's going to be a riot. The Klan has kind of mobilized the people, and they're burning crosses, and guys wearing sheets are all over the place. And the sheriff realizes that if he actually frames somebody, the riot will be over. You know, it'll pacify the Klan. And he knows from past experience that the Klan have got guns and they're going to kill people, lots of people, unless he frames somebody. Now, the frame-up will involve executing an innocent man down the track, but it will save, say, 20 lives. So this is what the consequences would have to say. Let's look at the consequences. Well, the consequences are such that only one person will be killed in the frame-up, whereas, let's say, 20 will be killed if we don't frame-up. So weighing up the consequences, the frame-up has got to be the one that you do, and you don't have the riot.
It's dangerous to be a little bit more long-sighted. It might be the consequences of letting the Klan get away with all this. Maybe say, I could be a Klan around them.
And moreover, a large detachment of federal police heading down the road, and we'll be able to round up the Klan that morning, the morning after the riot would have taken place. I just changed the story, Guy. Okay? I just changed the story. I mean, this is make-believe. We changed the story. I changed it in such a way that we can entrap the Klan. You know, the frame-up will have the Klan walking around the jail all night saying, lynch him now, lynch the blank now. You know, we'll get him in the morning, but we can't do it tonight. Because the police haven't, the helicopters are all down. It's foggy night. I just changed the story. So, you know, there must be some ways of doing this in such a way that we have to be faced with a decision. Do you frame the innocent guy? Or maybe even let the Klan lynch him that night. Maybe you want to put it that way. Because maybe we could let the innocent guy go later on. But now let's say the Klan can lynch him that night. Just change the story a bit. And we will always get some kind of problem like this. And the problem precisely is in terms of a principle of justice. In justice, you should treat people equally. I guess that's what justice means. You should treat people equally, particularly in front of the law. So what the consequentialist demand seems to be is that we treat somebody unjustly. And strikes me that there can't be any more violation of justice than taking the life of somebody who's innocent. You know, that's kind of a fairly fundamentally unjust. Give us something unjust, well, let's take away somebody who's innocent's life. That seems to me to be kind of unjust. Yet consequentialism seems to dictate that that's what should be done in that case. Now, I think that's a problem. All of these problems, or most of these problems, are going to go like this. Some individual, or a couple of individuals, in this case, are going to be sacrificed for the general good of the community as a whole. So we might want to say, well, look, there were some experiments done. I think it's a seminar topic, and it's also in the latest book, The Atomic Scientist, there's something on it. After World War II, there were some experiments done, a number of experiments done on people for the effects of radiation. And some of them were done without the subject knowing about it. And the typical justification was, well, we could be faced with a nuclear war, and we needed to find out about the effects of radiation. Hence, those experiments had to be done. Now, the individual didn't know about them, the individuals in many cases didn't know about them, and they suffered because of the experiments, and they died early because they were given a little dose of plutonium, you know, in a very, very nice red wine, but nevertheless, the plutonium was in there. So, I mean, that doesn't seem to be just, does it, to experiment on people, but the idea was those individuals were, so to speak, expendable for the good of the community as a whole. So this kind of objection to consequentialism will always have that kind of form. Individuals' rights, individuals, etc., is going to be violated. And these are innocent individuals. They haven't done anything wrong for the good of the whole. And consequentialism is always going to kind of push in that direction by its very nature. Because what it does, it looks at end states and it maximizes them, it ranks them. This is the best, this is the worst. The best end state here, in the case of the experiments, is us knowing the effects of radioactivity. Because they're going to be nuclear war, because the communists are in party and they're all bastards. So we have to know about them. A state where these people are not irradiated, experimented on, isn't the best state. according to that calculation. So we can't let that happen. We've got to go for the best state. So this particular kind of objection to consequentialism will always have that form. And that worries me a whole lot. I don't know whether it worries you, but it worries me. Yes, my friend Norm said that in the first lectures I gave on that. That's a way of putting it. If you want to put it that way, sure. I mean, that's a... Why not? You know, you could put it that way. Or maybe you could put it in the way the fancy philosophers do. The theory of the good determines the theory of the right. Now, I mean, this is assuming that, you know, you talk in terms of means and ends. If you want to think of consequentialism that way, you can think of it that way. How do you justify that? Well, you might go back to Mill and say, we're purposive creatures. We act toward ends. In the sphere of morality, it's not just the particular end of the action, but a whole range of consequences that count. You see, end and consequence, I'm not sure it's quite the same thing. But I don't mind if you want to think of it that way. I'd rather you thought of it the way I put it. File exam. End justifies the means. Don't you mean that the theory of the good and the theory of the right? Get the jargon right. Karen Stacey hasn't, and I'll come back. Get the jargon, you can do anything. I mean, I just read off all this cultural policy stuff here and get the jargon right, and that'd be all right.
Should I say?
Sure. Look, I mean, I've sort of answered this a couple of times in different ways from people. And it's not quite the same question you asked, Karen. What you've got to do then is to kind of have an array of possible, how shall I put it, end states of the world that you estimate, best of your ability, are going to be following on your action. And you then look at those end states and decide which is the best. So you have to have if you think that the best one is where the most people are happy, then you've got to try to figure out what that is. If you think the best end state is one where everybody's interests are equally well promoted, you've got to figure out what that one is. Depends how you do it. So that's the thing that you have to estimate. Now, some people might say, well, that's difficult, isn't it? And you might well say, yeah, it's difficult. And if somebody says, well, that's impossible, you can't do it, that would then effectively hit consequentialism on the head if you can't do it. But then I would respond to that last point by saying, but we do act. And although we like going to the gym and just lift weights for the pleasure of it, we often do act for some end. And we can get a fairly good idea what the end can be. I have a fairly good idea. I'll get home tonight, you know, do stuff later on. I'm not fairly sure what's going to happen when I get home. Feed the cat. Drink heavily, you know, that kind of stuff. So I have a fairly good idea what's going to happen when I get home. No, I tell a lie. I will feed the cat. Technically, people offer discussions of things like expected utility, and they use risk and so on and so on and so on. So you get kind of technical. But I'm not so much concerned about those sort of issues. They're a little bit specialized for our purposes. How you really work out what these end states are going to be and how you assign measures of goodness and badness to them. They're kind of technical questions. If we were doing a whole degree in ethics or a whole course on consequentialism, we'd have to address them, but we're not.
I was going to ask how a consequentialist would defend himself given that kind of killed the citizen man.
He'd say this, roughly. He'd say, what would you do first? And I'd say, well, I'm a deontologist, I am. Know what that means. So I wouldn't kill the guy. And so he'd say, all right, well, you're in the following state. You believe something like this. You believe that you should not do an action called S. You shouldn't do S's, where S's might be saying, causing innocent people to die. You believe that you shouldn't do S. Now, if you don't, so you've got two states of affairs, and the one state of affairs we've got a 1 times S, one innocent person dies, another state of affairs where you've got 20 times S. Now, you're refusing to do that, so aren't you therefore implicitly bringing about this? So if you really hate doing this action, you've actually caused, in some sense of course, 20 of those actions to take place. So you're really up the wrong, you're really barking up the wrong tree, aren't you? That's the kind of thing they would say. And this is a very difficult thing to come back at, you see. I use the word cause advisedly there, because you didn't actually do it. did you, or did you? I mean, it's getting a little bit complicated, this. But that's the kind of response they would make. And this is why, it's not obviously the fact that from that particular example, we immediately conclude consequentialism is up the spout, and we've got to go the other way. Assume that it happened. I mean, assume we're trying. Assume it happened, and we're trying to evaluate. Suppose two situations happen: one, the guy was lynched, and one, he wasn't. Let's assume it happened. You know, back in the 30s, and we're sort of moral historians trying to make judgments about what should have been done and what shouldn't. You know, assume it happened. What do we say about the situations? Assume that there's no relevant difference between the two. These are really difficult problems, and there isn't any simple answer to it. I personally think that I couldn't lynch the guy. I mean, I think that would be too much. Some more problems for consequentialism. Just let's carry on. I like this one. I'm shipwrecked with Alison. She dies, but first extracts a promise. I must ensure her large fortune goes to her worthless lover, Wayne. Anybody called Wayne here? Clearly, anyway. I return to civilization where it becomes clear that utility will be better served if I gave the money to a woman's refuge, Wayne being worthless. Utilitarianism dictates I give the money to the refuge, but it seems to some that I ought to give it to worthless Wayne. If this is right, then utilitarianism is wrong. My version of the story is, I'm mountain climbing with my friend, who falls down a crevasse, and just on his deathbed in the crevasse says, I want to leave my money to my alcoholic uncle Fred, and he's got a lot of money. Please do it! Like that. What do I do? Do I give it to alcoholic uncle Fred, who only lasts another 6 weeks, but what are 6 weeks? Or do I give it to the woman's refuge? Now, utilitarianism says you give it to the woman's refuge because that's a better state of affairs in the world than giving it to either worthless Wayne or alcoholic Uncle Ted. Now, Charles's intuition, I've promised I'll give it to Wayne, I've promised I'll give it to alcoholic Uncle Ted. The intuition here is I should keep my promise, even if it goes against maximizing utility. Again, but the utilitarianism says, well, you can break promises under those conditions. I don't know what you make of that example. Again, are you waving your pen or are you going to ask something?
You're procrastinating.
Oh, carry on.
The idea that you have the option of giving it to the... like, where did the option come from?
Oh, you've got power of attorney. Okay, scrawls it on your wrist. Power of attorney, you know, sort of scrawl ends up like that because he's dead. She's dead. Well, Alison, off. Oh, God, it won't come on. So, you know, you can do it. You've got the power of attorney, so to speak.
So I didn't just get this money and...
You do have an option. You do have an option.
Arms right there and said, give this money to such and such. You wouldn't think about $100 million. Why don't I give it to somebody else? Because their last wish was to give it to this person.
You know, but you look, you... You know about the situation. You know Alison and worthless Wayne, and everybody says he's a joke. You know, not worth a nice Alison, and she can't help herself. But you know the background to it. Everybody thinks, oh, wouldn't it be better if she didn't have worthless Wayne? And now she's even helping Wayne after the grave. So you know a bit of the background. So in a sense, you got a bit of time to think about it. Maybe you're shipwrecked a bit longer. You know, you've got another couple of weeks. I mean, after all, you've been pinching the food off Alison's share, so you're a bit stronger than she was. It's refuge, it's obvious. Other people might think, no, you should keep your promise, particularly in this case, particularly when it's poor Alison's dying wish. There seems to be something nasty about violating somebody's dying wish. Here's a third problem. You can go on this for ages. This is more kind of applies to science, ethics, and values a bit more. Dr. Georgina is a geneticist with two infant children. Her health compels her to live in the country. There's only one job available, procured by her old professor, Chloe. He likes these little extra bits here. It's in biological warfare. Well, that's fairly obvious. Chloe tells Georgina that she knows she is not keen on germ warfare, but if she doesn't take the job, it'll go to the gung-ho Dr. Sophie, and the vile work will proceed at a greater pace. So either Georgina does not take the job, in which case she and her children will be poor, miserable, and worse, the biological weapons will be produced anyway, or she does take the job, in which case the weapons won't be quite so bad, and she and her children will be rich and happy. Consequentialism dictates that she takes the job. But, says Charles, that would be clearly wrong because it's a crime against her own integrity. Integrity. Acting in such a way as to be in conformity with what you believe in deeply. If you believe certain things and you then act against them, you have violated your own integrity. Integrity is supposed to be one of the old virtues. I mean, a person who has integrity acts in accordance with her beliefs that are deeply held. Dr. Georgina, if she does take the job, will be acting against what she believes in. She'll be doing something against her nature, if you like. But utilitarianism says, yeah, take the job. You know, look at the end states of the world, and the state of affairs which Georgina has the job is supposed to be a better state than the one where Dr. Chloe has the job, in terms of who's happier, how the kids are, whether Dr. Georgina's healthy, whether the weapons are being produced quicker or slower. You know, she might sneeze into the pneumonia, bacteria, whatever the hell, and slow it down a bit. Or when she's making rheumatic fever virus, modifying that so it's not so susceptible to the countermeasure, she might not modify it very well. You know, or when she's making the anthrax susceptible to being dropped on people, she might not do it quite so effectively. All the wonderful things that can be done. So again, according to this position, utilitarianism is giving us, according to Charles, the wrong way to go morally. If there weren't these sort of counterexamples, if there weren't these difficulties, then I don't think we would perhaps spend too long worrying about the alternative. But I think they're all problems. To my mind, they're all problems, particularly the first one, the question of justice, particularly the case where an innocent individual or several, they're sacrificed, so to speak, for the good of the whole. Now, that seems to be maybe in some cases the practical thing to do, maybe the prudent thing to do, the thing to do which is expedient. But is it the moral thing to do? That's really what that question raises. And if it's not the moral thing to do, then how are we going to address the questions of morality in those sorts of cases? Are we forced into this awful situation where we have to accept the fact that 20 people are going to have this? And S can be any, I mean, I just put it, S in this case, to be killed. I mean, all sorts of things could happen. Maybe by keeping your promise to Georgina, you've unleashed the lying wane on the world, and the lying wane's main object in life is to increase lying. He's kind of a reverse sort of moralist, and his code is lying is good, maximize lying in the world. So he's going to set up a liar's institute and republish the Hackenthorpe Book of Lies, which says, among other things, the highest mountain in the world is 8 inches tall. The Hackenthorpe Book of Lies, he's going to do that. So by keeping your promise, you're increasing promise-breaking and truth-telling. Maybe what's happening in the integrity case, well, I don't know, it's not so clear how I can modify that one, but maybe by Georgina keeping her integrity and not taking the job, lots of other people's integrities will become compromised and so on. So whatever, this is a big argument for the consequentialist. Whatever it is you won't do, kill an innocent, break a promise, violate your integrity, whatever. By not doing that, let's imagine a circumstance where the violation of precisely what you hold dear becomes maximized if you don't do it. There's more killing if you refuse to kill. There's more promise-breaking if you keep a promise. There are more compromisings of integrity if you hold your integrity. And that then becomes seems to put the onus back on the people that want to hold this view, to give them some justification. So that becomes a very difficult point to make. And these things can be, these problems that are raised in this little lecture handout from Otago, I guess they can be put back again onto the person that is arguing for those positions. So this is the way the consequentialist fights back, so to speak. Okay, I think you might like to think about those things and see what you make of them. Let me now move on to say something about non-consequentialism, and I shouldn't expect I can finish it today, but we can make a start. I'm not too worried about this because we've got a little bit of flexibility in the lecture handout. Okay, so if consequentialism is focusing on the consequences, if you want to call it the ends, call it the ends, and subordinating the means to the ends, the other kind of ethics does the other thing. It focuses on action and says moral sanction, moral goodness, moral badness attaches to the actions that you perform, not the consequences that those actions bring about. So that does presuppose that we can distinguish actions from consequences, and I'll try and talk about that this time next week, and I'll say something about that paper over that ethics conference where the handouts were peculiar and the overheads were all stuffed up. So I'll say that next time, but let's assume we can make that distinction. So again, on these views, it's the, again, just putting it in the technical terms, it's the right, it's the action which is important, and so to speak, the good is in little letters. So this is going to be the other kind of view, the non-consequentialist view. It says it's the actions have got to be defined as right, and right actions produce things that are good, as opposed to good, the end states, which are important, and if you produce good, then you've done the right thing. So little kind of diagram there to explain the differences between these sorts of things. This kind of ethic, or one of the varieties of non-consequentialist ethics, is something called deontological or duty ethics. It's from the Greek deon, meaning duty, and you often see it, this as being the contrast from the Greek deon equals duty. Been referred to as duty ethics. Whether there are any other kinds of non-consequentialism but the ontological is not something I'm going to worry about, particularly in this sequence of lectures. Now, again, just to make the contrast between the two kinds of ethics, if you remember my little mini theory about truth-telling, if we have a value, truth-telling is valuable. The consequentialist says maximize truth-telling. The other guys, these guys, the consequentialist guys, would say always tell the truth. Now again, as I said, the difference between the two is that one wants to maximize truth-telling, and that might involve lying, maximize promising, that might involve breaking promises, etc., etc. These people will keep their promises, will not lie, and so on. And I said that's sometimes called honoring the value. That might be one way of putting it. You honor the value. That's what the consequentialist, non-consequentialist does. Now, I actually want to approach this not by speaking specifically about the duty, because I find duties are kind of amorphous. I find it hard to get a handle myself on duty. You have a duty of care if you're a nurse. You have a duty to do this. Where do these duties come from? What do they attach to? I find it rather easier to talk not about duties, but to talk about rights. And rights theory I'm going to classify as a kind of non-consequentialist theory of ethics. I'm not sure whether it's right to call it a deontological theory of ethics, but that's a technicality that the experts can argue about. I'd like to say something about rights. And the reason that these do impinge upon this other kind of ethic is because rights and duties are, so to speak, correlative. Where there's a right, there's a correlative duty. And so if we talk about rights, we do introduce duties in some kind of way. So talking about rights is a way of talking about duties. So one way that we might think about how this is worked out formally would be something like this. Let's get a list of rights. What might they be? We'll start off by what will they be? The right to life, liberty, happiness, whatever you think the people have rights to. That might be a list of those things. And we might then, in order to get a value specification, simply add on are valuable. Just trying to connect this up with what I told you about theories of ethics. I said theories of ethics have, in the first place, a value specification, and secondly, an action condition. We might think of this as constructing some kind of value specification by writing out a list of rights, whatever they might be. Think about what rights there are. what we think are valuable, and just add on a valuable. And then for the action specification, it might be something like respect, honor these rights. The respecting and the honoring are things that you do, and that's going to determine how these things are valuable. So it's these actions which are important here. It's these things which are going to determine the kind of a view about ethics that we have if we go this way. It's what you do with respect to these rights. Honoring them, respect them, etc., is going to be the thing which is giving this some kind of content. Well, I'll say a little bit more about rights to put it in some kind of context, and then I'll try and tell you a bit more about how rights work next time. One question that's worth asking here, it seems to me, if you have this view about rights, is to ask what they are. What's a right? Okay, thank you very much. What sort of thing is a right, exactly, if it's something which is supposed to figure in ethical theories and it's supposed to be valuable? Well, that's actually quite a difficult question, unfortunately. If it was an easy question, I'd tell you the answer. Lots of difficult questions in this course, that's one of them. I'd rather not prejudge the question as to what a right is, because if I tell you what I think precisely it is, that might close off discussion about matters of interest later in the course, such as, do animals have rights? And if they don't, why not? And if they do, why? I'd rather not, therefore, say exactly what we might think a right substantially is. But let me conclude. I've got a couple of minutes to tell you something about the background of rights. I think this might be useful, and it might not, but I'll conclude the lecture because it'll only take me a couple of minutes to do it, about where rights came from. So, little 5 minutes on the evolution of the concept of a right, very, very quickly. I think this is worth saying because it says something about some other tradition of ethics as well. It evolved out of a particular conception of natural law. It evolved out of a conception of natural law which held that natural law applies not merely to the inanimate world, but also to the animate world and to us as well. This conception of natural law, we might say that this is the sphere of natural law, and inside it there are, say, the laws that we typically study in science these days, laws of physics, etc. But there are also laws that govern human behavior. It says human behavior, Helen. That says, phew. No, I just write on the board for therapy. It calms me down. You're not supposed to be able to read it. Human behavior, that says. And this will be the laws that govern the natural world, the non-animate bit. It's called natural law, so it's all confused, but anyway. Laws that society enacts are called, by contrast, positive law. Can still use that terminology now. So positive law might be you're only allowed to drink if you're over 0.05. They had this petition going at Le Cork a while back. I signed it 15 times. That will be a positive law. It will be a convention. It used to be held that actual expressions of laws, social laws like this, were supposed to be reflecting the laws of human behavior that held. Now, in terms of Christian morality, these have been laid down by God, and so the positive laws will be some expression of the laws that God gave. So this would tie up morality very nicely, and these were then supposed to govern our moral behavior. Would that it was true. This doesn't work, and it couldn't work. It doesn't work, in my opinion, because the laws of human behavior that we were talking about then would involve no choice. And it seems to me that the essence of moral behavior is that we choose to do the right thing, we choose to produce the good, and we choose to avoid the bad, and we choose to avoid the wrong. But if it were the case that we were governed by natural law, we would have no choice. A body has no choice but to fall at a certain acceleration. A chemical reaction of a certain kind has no choice but to take place. These natural laws have a certain necessity about them. Whenever I drop this, it falls at a certain rate. It's not true that whenever I behave, I have to behave in a certain way. At least that's certainly what I believe. I don't believe my behavior is determined. I believe it's a matter of choice. If it were true that natural laws govern all human behavior as well as all natural behavior, we would have no choice in what we do. And it strikes me then there would be no such thing as morality. Morality surely is concerned with us choosing to do the right thing and not the wrong thing. Anyway, that difference between the way inanimate things behave and the way purposive creatures like us behave became fairly well accepted in the period of the Renaissance, about 1814, 1750. About the time of the Renaissance, people began to realize that really this ancient doctrine of natural law didn't work. So if one was then wondering about what underpinned human behavior, it couldn't be natural law. It happened that rights theory evolved out of this rejection of natural law. The detail of it is not something I'm going to go into, but it was a reflection of a gentleman called Grotius, who was thinking about the nature of warfare and where it was governed by human behavior, natural laws and so forth, suggested that perhaps in warfare, even though it's not governed by any kind of law, there aren't any laws of war, people do have rights in war. And these things that he called rights were going to determine not our behavior specifically as subjects, but the behavior of others toward us. We had certain rights. We had certain rights if we were non-combatants, for example. This is in the 16th century. Grotius is writing about rights. I just give you this as background. I don't know whether it's very helpful or not, but this is where the concept of a right started to evolve at this particular time. Its evolution very quickly went from Grotius to the great guy who was important in this regard, called John Locke, who was developing some conceptions of rights. And John Locke influenced the following person. I have to find the passage. I didn't look it up beforehand because I was talking to my student. Hope I can find it. Here we go. You have to tell me who said this, when, and in what context. And you have to pick the accent too. We hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable. It's not Lyndon Johnson. That all men, I'll say it in English, that all men are created equal and independent. I'll start again. We hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable. That all men are created equal and independent. That from that equal creation they derive rights, inherent and inalienable, among which are the preservation of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Yes, clever fellow. In what context? Somebody else? No. Declaration of Independence, about 1800. Jefferson was mightily influenced by John Locke, and also the Marquis de Montesquieu, who were writing about these matters. Anyway, it's hell to spell Montesquieu, I tell you. No, that's wrong. Is it Q-U-I-E-I? Oh, hell, I don't know. I used to go to school, Montesquieu, when I was younger. So, rights have a big tradition in the United States. They were influenced very much by the work of John Locke, and I'll come back at that point next time and say something about how rights are connected to duties. Okay.